Good morning, everyone. This workshop starts at 11, and I've got 11:03. So, welcome to the Regardless of Sexuality workshop of WCNA 31. My name is Tammy, and I'm an addict. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. Can we please have a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer? God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. First, change the things I can. And wisdom to know the difference.
Thanks. I've asked Susan from Kansas City to read What is the Narcotics Anonymous Program?
Hi, I'm Susan. I'm an addict. And this is What is the Narcotics Anonymous Program. NA is a nonprofit fellowship or society of men and women for whom drugs have become a major problem. We are recovering addicts who meet regularly to help each other stay clean. This is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. There is only one requirement for membership, the desire to stop using. We suggest that you keep an open mind and give yourself a break. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. The most important thing about them is that they work. There are no strings attached to NA. We are not affiliated with any other organizations. We have no initiation fees or dues, no pledges to sign, no promises to make to anyone. We are not connected with any political, religious, or law enforcement groups, and are under no surveillance at any time. Anyone may join us regardless of age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion. We are not interested in what or how much you use, who your connections were, what you have done in the past, how much or how little you have, but only what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. The newcomer is the most important person in any meeting because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. We have learned from our group experience that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean.
Thanks, Susan. And Pinky from San Jose is going to read Why Are We Here?
Good morning, family. I'm an addict. My name is Pinky, Northern California, San Jose. Okay. Why are we here? Before coming to the Fellowship of NA, we could no longer manage our own lives. We could not live and enjoy life as other people do. We have had something different. We had to have something different, and we thought we found it in drugs. We placed the use ahead of the welfare of our families, our wives, husbands, and our children. We had to have drugs at all costs. We did many people great harm, but most of all, we harmed ourselves. We're usually creating our own problems. We seem to be incapable of facing life on its own terms. Most of us realized that in our addiction, we were slowly committing suicide. But addiction is such a cunning enemy of life that we had lost the power to do anything about it. Many of us ended up in jail or sought help through medicine, religion, or psychiatry. None of these methods was sufficient for us. Okay, I lost myself. I'm nervous. Our disease always resurfaced and continued to progress until, in desperation, we sought help from each other in Narcotics Anonymous. After coming to NA, we realized we were sick people. We suffered from a disease for which there is no known cure. It can, however, be arrested at some point, and recovery is impossible.
Thanks, Pinky. At this time, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Joni from Illinois.
Well, hi, everyone. My name is Joni, and I'm a grateful recovering addict. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to speak. I have this phone system that forwards all my calls, and I was sitting at work when I got the call, and I almost fell off my chair. I'm thinking, I didn't send any tape in or anything, you know? And I found out last night that a friend of mine that's on the World Committee, well, it's the night before last, put me into the pool and nominated me to speak. So then they told me about my topic.
And I said, well, you know what? That sounds like the gay and lesbian meeting. And I'm straight. So, and I'm going, so what the hell am I going to talk about? Oh, that I got a lot of gay friends. That sounds real stupid, you know? Oh, I accept them. But, and it was really weird because, you know, it was about sexuality, and I'm trying to think, you know, okay, I have to talk about 2 minutes on it because I consider myself a born-again virgin. So, you know, it's really no sexuality. Not by choice. But let me start with, I am really going to talk about my sexuality, though, and how it related to me in my using and my recovery. My family upbringing was devoid of a lot of physical, gregarious, kind of loving kind of stuff. You know, I don't ever remember my mother holding me and caressing me. I remember my father, but I don't remember getting any of that kind of affection from my mother. And the only thing that physical that I could ever remember getting from my mother was getting beat. And so I've had a weight problem almost all my life. And when I got into junior high school, it started really bothering me because I was, you know, attracted to guys, and I wanted to date like all the other girls. And when I was a freshman in high school, I started starving myself and became anorexic, in a sense. I never got skinny, man. I don't know what the hell. I'm serious. Never got skinny. Would eat every other day, you know. And but as soon as the weight started coming off, all of a sudden, man, guys started looking at me, you know, and I started becoming this sexual being. And I remember that feeling of power I had, and it was such a rush that I had this power in my hands, this sexuality. And I used it to my advantage. I was such a needy girl. God, was I needy. And I needed that touching, that caressing, that holding. And I fell in love with my first love at 15. And I used sex continuously with him to keep him closer to me. You know, no, I don't want you to leave, so I'll play with you, you know. And it was always manipulating for me to get more. I needed more of him because he made me feel like I was somebody. And through my whole adulthood and childhood, you know, and adolescence, every man that I ever had a relationship with, I would push them so hard until they would eventually start hitting me. And and every single one of them would tell me, man, that's the first time I ever hit a woman. You know, and it was like I was like a radar. I could see that propensity in that man that I could pull that out of him because that's all I knew. You know, that's why I was so confused. I thought that that was part of love because of the way I was raised. And this continued on through every relationship. When I wasn't in the relationship, I was searching for one. You know, I was doing the one-night stands just to get some semblance of hold me, love me, you know, be part of me. And I'd always wake up the next day and go, man, I feel like shit. I don't feel good. You know, I feel dirty. You know, I used the my sexuality as a weapon. I used it as a power trip. I used it in every way possible to get drugs. You know, I don't know how many of us haven't used it in that sense. But, you know, and I always told myself that, you know, it's not about the drugs. It's just that, you know, hey, I like sex, you know. What the hell? But he just so happened to have, you know, a bag on him, you know. If he didn't have a bag on him, forget it, you know. And in the end, you know, I used it strictly about getting more, you know. I got to the point where I could read men, in which I always picked two types of guys, ones that were really inexperienced with drugs, thinking that they could get sex if they bought some with, you know, and do it with me, and other ones that were just as addicted to me that I knew once they got a hit, sex wasn't in the picture, you know, because it was just more. You know, I could basically sniff them out, you know, and I would go after them. When I hit my bottom, I had just gotten out of a relationship with a guy that I went with for 3 years that I didn't even like, because that's how needy I was. I just needed someone there. And I was starting to date dealers because they were such nice people, you know. And, you know, this is a crap that I would tell myself. Oh, they're such... You know, he's really cute, you know, right. Yeah, I wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole, intelligence of a worm, you know. But he had it, you know, and I needed it. And one of my last binges, the thing that got me fired from my job, which made me hit my bottom, was with a dealer and a cop. And... then again, you know, I used my sexuality the whole time, and I ended up waking up, not knowing where I was, in this basement, naked, on a mattress on the basement floor, and thinking, what in the hell am I doing? You know, I had to be at some kind of a meeting that was for people who didn't know how to have relationships, communication relationships at work. They had got to that point where they were sending me, they didn't know that I was, you know, an addict. It was just that, you know, I was going through withdrawal at work and being a real ass and didn't know how to communicate with anyone. And so here I am, still loaded from the night before, driving to work, passing out at the wheel as I'm going to this class, get lost, can't find it, walk in, absolutely reeking, and just, you know, I could tell that when I walked in the room, everyone could smell me, you know, because it was like a 3-day binge. And she took one look at me and says, I think you need to go back to work. And I ended up getting fired that day. And that's the thing that brought me to my knees. That whole situation of me ending up in that basement. That wasn't the first time me ending up in the basement, you know? But that one had, like, particular significance because, like, the light bulb went on. And something weird happened to me. I decided to go and I went into treatment, and something weird happened to me when I was in treatment. And, I would say it was about the second week in treatment. I got a sex drive. It's like, what in the hell is this? Because I hadn't felt one in so long. And it was like every cell in my body was screaming, I need it, I need it, I need it, I need it so bad. And we were like idiots in heat in there. You know, the next thing I know, I'm in the closet with some guy. It lasted all of like 3 minutes. And feeling like shit afterwards again. And telling myself, I don't ever want to feel like this again. I don't ever want to feel like a piece of meat again, you know? Because that's how I felt, you know? He got his jollies, I got nothing. And I in early recovery, I had such a low self-esteem. I was also, the anorexia turned into bulimia because some guy told me that, why don't you, ask me how I lost the weight when I was in school. And I says, oh, well, I just don't eat. And he says, well, God, do it like the wrestlers do, my friend. He wants to make a weight, and he just throws it all up. And I thought, man, that is the best idea on earth. I can have my cake and eat it, too, you know. And later on, you know, through working the steps and tons of therapy, I found out that was just a way of me releasing my anger. You know, and, but, you know, here I was, and everyone knows that when they get into recovery, they start gaining weight, and the freak machine went on upstairs. I can't do this because there's no way I'll get a guy, you know. I gotta really pump up this bulimia so that I stay, you know, without losing weight, you know, not gain weight, you know. And no matter what I did, I started gaining weight. My self-esteem started dropping again, you know. And but the wonderful men in this fellowship, some of the wonderful men in this fellowship, not all, because there's a lot of really good guys, love to... I don't know, get to know newcomers on a more intimate basis. And they started doing it to me. And I heard about this no relationships for the first year thing, and I said, man, you people are nuts. How in the hell am I going to go a year without sex? You know, I mean, I need a relationship. You know, because I need that man to heal me. I need that man to fix me. I need that man. Some guy at a dance comes up to me, starts hitting on me. We're dancing and all that and telling me all the things I want to hear. And he asked me out on a date. And I thought, oh, good, here's the one. You know, this is the one that I'm going to hook up with. He's really cute, you know, he's nice. And he goes to me, well, you know, I was a little in trouble with the law and I got to spend like about a year in jail. Could you wait for me? And I said, and I thought, what in the hell, man? I picked the most dysfunctional person on earth. You know, this is the people who I am attracted to, you know. I suck them in like a magnet. This, and for the first time, it kind of made sense why you don't get in a relationship for the first year. You know, is that I tend to attract the same people over and over. You know, and if I'm sick, that's all I'm going to attract is sick. You know, and I was sick and tired of having that same person and never getting my needs met. Because, you know, we'd always have that one little crumb in the middle of the table for getting needs met, right? And both of us are trying to snatch that crumb, continually snatching that crumb and blaming the other person. Well, you don't meet my needs. Well, you don't meet my needs. Well, you don't meet my needs. Well, you're not meeting my needs. You know, and it took me a long time that I need to know myself first to be able to know how to get, I didn't even know how to get my needs met. Needs met. in that it wasn't going to be no short thing. It was going to be a long journey, you know, because I never got a Met when I was a kid. So how the hell am I supposed to learn how to get a Met now? And so I started really working on me. And my sponsor had me do cute little things like affirmations on the mirrors and all that good stuff, you know, working on the steps. But I think the basic thing that really, really started me on the road of self-acceptance and was working the steps. When I started working the steps, I started accepting myself for who I was. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because I had a lot of guilt and shame about what I did sexually when I was out there. You know, I did a lot of kinky things, you know, for looking for love, you know. And had a lot of guilt, tremendous amount of guilt about what I did. And what I realized that once I started working the steps and looking at this stuff, that it started falling away, that the guilt started, you know. One of the things that made me feel good, now this is horrible, but one of the things that made me feel that I wasn't that deviant was I was at this meeting with a guy who had a ton of clean time, and we were cleaning up after the meeting and all that, and the meeting was on the fourth or the fifth step, I don't know which one, but you know, he was talking about how you know, these guys think that they're so unique when they read these things to me, you know, when they do their fifth step and all that, and that you know, everything that they've done is so horrible. And he says, man, I'm starting to fall asleep during them because they're all about the same thing over and over. He says, if I have to hear one more time about some guy and an animal. And I went. Well, at least I didn't do the donkey thing. the year is going on, in my first year, I keep gaining weight. And my self-esteem was getting lower and lower and lower. And I couldn't come out and tell people how bad I felt about myself, you know. And and it was a really slow process to be able to heal. I think the huge turning point came when my sponsor saw about this therapist that was working with people with body image problems, and she had this huge long workshop, you know, it was like 16 weeks or something. And I went into that and, you know, started realizing that it really is, you know, really an inner job, you know. And she told us how to examine how women think about themselves and their sexuality, and how when we look in the mirror, what are we saying to ourselves? You know, most of us will look in the mirror and say, God, man, you look like shit, you know, and look at you, you fat slob. What the hell are you doing? You know, and I never realized that I had that such negative thought continuously going through my head with myself, and how much I despised the way I looked, how much I felt that the only way that I could be a desirable human being if a man was desired me. You know, and it was really, really a turning point in my life, you know, to look at that kind of stuff. because I always thought it was an outside job. I never thought it was an inside job. And
I
decided to start dating, okay? So this was after like 3.5 years of being clean. And I decided, okay, I'm going to give it a try, you know. I have no idea how the hell to act on a date. Every relationship I was ever in, I found in a bar. You know, and it was a result of a one-night stand. You know, I never really went on dates. You know, and decided to give it a try. And I was really screwed up. I had to have someone teach me how to date, you know. And thank God I was involved in a group where there was a lot of loving men that helped me through it. And it was like their favorite thing. I'd come in, you know, these guys, most of them were married and stuff. And I'd come in and, okay, how'd the date go? You know, this is their whole, their whole excitement of the week is my social life for some reason. But I felt so comfortable with these guys. And, you know, and I thank the men of this fellowship because I wouldn't know how to do this stuff. They taught me how to do this stuff. They taught me boundaries because I had none. I didn't know what the hell was proper or not, you know. I mean, for instance, this one guy calls me up and immediately starts talking to me about my breast size, you know, and I got that icky feeling in my stomach. But of course, because I had no boundaries, I didn't relate to it. And ended up making a date with him. And I went to my meeting that night and I says, you know, I don't know, I'm just feeling a little bit apprehensive about what was said on the phone with this guy. I don't know whether that's normal or not. Is that normal? And I got so much wonderful feedback from these men in my life that I had the courage to call this guy up and said, I don't want to go out with you, you know. And it was the first time that I've ever had the amount of self-respect for myself to be able to do that, you know, because I was so boundaryless that I was, for instance, when I was a teenager, I was raped multiple times and really didn't even know I was raped. That's how little boundaries I had. And I would sit there and talk to these guys afterwards, after they raped me, you know. So that's the kind of boundaries I had. I didn't have any. And so this guy talking to me that way, I had no idea if this was disrespectful or not. And man, that was a huge step for myself to be able to open up my mouth and have the courage to call this guy back and say, I don't think I want to go out with you, you know. And I tried to, I dated and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and it seems like everyone I'm meeting is an idiot. God, you know, everyone I'm meeting, you know, is blaming the world for their problems. And, you know, I know that I ain't supposed to blame the world for my problems, you know. It's like, man, shut up and do something about it. You know, this is what I want to tell these people. You know, shut up, go out and do something about it if you don't like it. And I started really getting upset that I wasn't meeting anyone, you know, that I could have a real meaningful relationship with. And, you know, I would get, oh, what's wrong with me, you know, and really that unbelievable lonely yearning in my gut, you know. And I remember one night I was walking into my house and all of a sudden I started crying really deep, one of them real, you know, gut, freaking right from the gut, and going, you know, God, I don't know why you want me here alone. But you know what?
And this was the hardest thing I ever told myself in my life. If that's what you want for me, I accept it. Well, okay, God, come on, man. After I said that, I still ain't in a relationship. Hey, that's the one that's going to give me the relationship. You know? I always had that little sick thought in our head, you know? Well, maybe this one. I'm so sacrificing here, God, that... No, but, you know, I mean, I really truly meant it. I really, for the first time, felt okay. I felt okay. Okay, if this is what you want in my life, I give it to you. You know, maybe I'm here to help other people in this program. And let me tell you, I've dedicated my life to this program. You know, and what I've learned is that I don't need a man in my life. I want one. It would be really nice to have a relationship, but I don't need. Because I can get fulfilled in many other places. I have very close relationships with men. Oh, he's sitting right there. And he's married. You know, and when I need a hug, I ask for it. You know, if I need someone, I have friends, male friends that I could tell them to hold me and I can cry. If I need that kind of feeling in relationship with someone, that closeness. You know, I have women that I can hold and cry. You know, this fellowship has changed me so much. And it really is, you know, an inside job. It was so neat. I was talking at a meeting. My home group is Yuppies Are Addicts Too. On Thursday nights at 7:30 in Naperville, Illinois. Yeah! And that's because Naperville's like, you know, real hoity-toity. And, you know, for years they always said, there's no addicts in Naperville. Ta-da! And guess what? Our meetings are packed. And I was talking at my home group. And, you know, when I was talking about feelings and emotions and getting inside of us and blah, 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 and spirituality and all this, and this newcomer guy comes up to me after the meeting and says to me, you know what? I can tell you have got an absolutely beautiful soul. I would rather have someone say that to me any day than someone say, man, baby, you're hot. What a difference. Do you want to know the cloud I walked in out of? And I said, thank you, God. I know why I'm here. You know? I know why I'm here today. I have a purpose in life. You know, and if I choose to be this androgynous human being, be it, you know? Because I've got close people in my life that love me, and... this fellowship has just given me so much. It's unbelievable. I want to thank everyone that showed up for this workshop. And the friendly faces that I see from the Chicago region, because Naperville's part of the Chicago region. You know, it's just unbelievable that I was even chosen for this. And in closing, I want to talk about what happened to me right before I came up here. And I was filling out the little card. They give you a little card that you fill out if you're a speaker so you can get a CD. And I'm standing there looking for a pen, you know, looking for my pen, getting ready to fill it out. And my sister's here. Yay, sis.
Yeah, she came with me. She's from Key Largo, Florida. Yeah. And she noticed this woman standing in line, you know, we're not too happy, you know, little tears running down her cheeks. And she says, oh, are you okay? I turn around and I look and she's crying. I says, oh my God, do you want to talk? And she says, yeah, I'd like to talk. And I says, well, this can happen later. Let's go and sit down and talk. Well, she's fairly new in the program, and she had gotten into a relationship, and she came with a guy here, and it wasn't working out. And tell you the truth, I didn't know what I was going to talk about before I came up here. I'm serious. When I'm walking here, I'm telling my sister, what in the hell am I going to talk about? You know, my sexuality lasts about 2 seconds, you know? And so she, you know, and I'm saying, man, is this a God thing or what? You know, and I says, now I know what I need to talk about. I need to talk about how you don't need a man or a woman in your life to feel whole and have a purpose on this earth and be fulfilled and happy. You know, God comes into my life all the time and tells me, shows me the path. Sometimes it has to be pretty big billboards because I don't get it. But other times, you know what, I can see it. You know, this was God telling me that this is what I needed to talk about. You know, I'm a woman and I don't have a relationship, and that's okay. And I haven't had a relationship in years, and that's okay. You know? And I'm truly grateful to be here, and I want to thank the committee again, and I'll keep coming back.
Now I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Shane C. from California.
I'm Shane, I'm an addict. She said, have fun. It feels like it's been a really long journey getting to this point right here. I think that you should be told that you're going to share at a workshop when you get here, instead of like months ago. Anyway, I'm really grateful to get to be here with you, among you, part of you. I know why I was chosen for this workshop. They asked, I told. and I'm grateful, you know, I'm grateful that there is such a workshop, that there can be this at a world convention of Narcotics Anonymous. And regardless of sexuality versus sexual identity, I don't know that there's any difference. Some people may have noted that or not. But it is what it is, regardless of sexuality. So whether you are straight or gay or bisexual or transsexual or trisexual, or the try-anything people, you are welcome here. And, yes, I know there's many of you in this meeting. If you're pre-op or post-op or any of that, pre-hormone, post-hormone, you are welcome here. And I like to say that the third tradition supersedes the title of any meeting. It really does. It supersedes the title of any meeting. And I know that I could be in the middle of someplace where there's not a lot of meetings or something, and my butt's fallen off, on a Tuesday night, and if there's only a women's meeting in town, I'm there. And, you know, that's just how I feel. The third tradition is big. It's bigger than the title. And, you know, I never know what to share. I don't know what anybody needs to hear. All I can do is talk about my own experience. You know, I even though, you know, we occasionally get to speak at conventions or whatever, or at our home group, or there's a title involved, or the name, or the theme, and I don't know that I can always cater my share to match that theme, you know. Sexuality works. I mean, I can talk about this. But, so I don't know what anybody needs to hear from me. All I can do is share my own experience and hope that you listen and maybe get something out of it. Because what I've learned over time is that we are not different. We're not different. It doesn't matter who you sleep with, what drugs you use, how old or young you are. It doesn't matter that we're not different. If you are here at this meeting or listening to this CD or tape or whatever, and you consider yourself an addict, you understand pain. You understand suffering. You understand degradation. And if you've been here for a minute, you have felt some hope. That's why you came back. So we're not different. Being here for a little while and experiencing some relief from addiction, relief from suffering, that's why I keep coming. So if we can share on that basis together, then we're having a great meeting. There's been a lot of things happen in the last couple of years and having to do with people that I considered those who walked before me, who've passed on. And I just want to dedicate this particular share to my friends who've left, who've crossed over. And some of those people include Tony Leone, Jim Stevens. Please do not take my picture. Please do not. Thank you. Jim Stevens and Buddy Kronberg from San Francisco, who was my grand sponsor, and he passed away this last July with 28 years. And I'm grateful that I got to know these people, that I got to see them in action, that I got to see Tony, who was very, very sick. He might have weighed 80 pounds, and he was still the vice chair of San Francisco area, and showing up, all of them, of service to the last. And that is a powerful example, and I want to be part of that and live in that that place that they lived in, of service and being of help to others. Now I can tell you that when I first came to Narcotics Anonymous, when I came to a very special area, and I know your home areas are your special areas, but I come from another very special area, the Napa Solano Fellowship in the Northern California region. And and when I came to Narcotics Anonymous to that area, I was not comfortable with Shane, obviously. I mean, you know, I didn't come here on a winning streak. Didn't come here happy, joyous, or free. I came here full of fear and self-loathing and hatred, and I could not have relationships with other men, unless it was about sex. And so when I got here, and I was so desperate, and I couldn't be, I just had to judge the men before they could judge me. I was afraid that they would like see past my tough guy veneer, and because my hair was like down to here, and I had a big beard, and stay back, and you know what? I gravitated towards the women, and it was the women who initially just took me in and just loved me. It was the women who helped save my life in the beginning. It really was the women, but. In short order, there were men in the area, in Vacaville, Fairfield, Northern California, who were like, we don't care. We know you. We don't care who you're sleeping with. We don't care. There's the men's meeting on Monday night at 6 o'clock in Fairfield. Have your ass there. I'm coming to get you. And they did. And they just welcomed me. It didn't matter. And I couldn't, it was so hard to accept that I could actually be loved like that. I was so suspicious of that kind of acceptance and love. You know, I thought that there had to be something behind it. There had to be something at play here. And come to find out, no, that it really was about acceptance and love. Now, at that time, there was not a meeting. There was not a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender meeting in the Napa-Solano area. But we started one, and that meeting went for a long time. And what I can say from my own experience is that I'm grateful. Hi, Albert. I'm grateful, having been a newcomer and having had exposure to other gays and lesbians in my area at the gay lesbian meeting on Sunday night at 6 o'clock, and feeling that different kind of an acceptance, different kind of love and comfort and safety that I did not feel in the other meetings. Okay? That was my stuff. That was my stuff. And that was the stuff of all the people that were going to that meeting too. We were going there for that particular sense of safety, being around each other. And that was kind of like my first exposure to that kind of unity, okay, being around my kind. But I didn't really get it at that time. It wasn't until later, after I'd, you know, worked a staff with a sponsor, and it was of service, and was all over the service spectrum, and H&I, and PI, and activities, and ASC, and RSC, and all that stuff, that it didn't matter. That ultimately it didn't matter. What I can say now is that that meeting lasted as long as it needed to. That meeting went on for about 6 years. And what happened was we, all of us gays and lesbians and transgenders and bisexuals and transsexuals and trisexuals, we didn't need it anymore. That's just my area. That was my area. Now, I know that's not the case in most every other place, but that experience that I had with those other men who were like, oh, no, you're coming to the men's meeting with us. You're going to the men's spiritual retreat with us. Oh, no, I don't care about none of that. That was really how it was area-wide, that I could go to any meeting and talk about what I needed to talk about and share what I needed to share, and that after I started working on the inside, that I started feeling more part of you, us, it, that it didn't matter. And then we outgrew the meeting, and we didn't need it. How wonderful is that? That we didn't need a special little meeting for ourselves, that we were accepted fellowship-wide. Wow. And so, even though I appreciate and still will go to a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender meeting, GLBT meeting, it's a mouthful, isn't it? We're going to add more letters, too. Watch out. And I'll still go, you know, and there is a special kind of, you know, camaraderie that we feel with each other that we might not, you know, share in regular meetings, but it's not something that I need anymore. And I'm grateful that it was there. Just like any other kind of what we consider common needs or special interest meetings, that it really is a place for newcomers that might find sanctuary in that kind of a meeting. So there's definitely a need for it, you know, in whatever area you're in. And if that need arises, absolutely, cool, go for it. Now, obviously, I'm sure some of you are from some area or region where special interest meetings are not allowed, where you get a lot of flack. You really have to fight to exist. And, you know, more power to you. More power to you for that. Now, probably like most, at least the gay men here, I came here with problems with acting out addictively with sex. And so, actually, when I got to NA, I first came to Narcotics Anonymous in Salt Lake City, Utah. I say Salt Lake City, Utah. And right on. And and you know what? Sexuality and acting out addictively was not something I could deal with. And I continued to do it. I continued to act out And from December of 1993 until I got clean in July 1994, I was in and out. And it was all around sex. It was all about sex, 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 and acting out in every way I could. And whenever I was doing my drugs of choice, I was either seeking or doing it. And when I went out the last time, you know, I had moved back to Northern California and had, you know, I'd get like 90 days, 60 days, a couple weeks, and every time I'd be done, I'm done, I'm done. And people just loved me. They just kept loving me. And I was hating myself, and they just kept loving me. And I felt so much shame about that, so much shame about continuing to relapse. And the last time I went out, I was out there for 2 months. And when I came back in that last time, I was so, so tore up. It was like I was like at the end of that rope that's been frayed. That's how I felt. I felt like a frayed end of rope, and I'd been beat around. And my sponsor said, you know, you have this little pattern going on. Get laid, get loaded, get laid, get loaded, get laid, get loaded. And he goes, why don't you consider the suggestion that's offered to most every other newcomer in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous? Pick a date. Pick a time. A time frame. And I was like, oh. And then I kicked and screamed for a millisecond until it hit me that, okay, I can continue to do what I've been doing and continue facing what I've been facing or change. Okay. 6 months. I said 6 months. He didn't say a year. You know, he didn't put that on me. And I can tell you that that was a tough thing. But guess what? One of the things I hadn't really started to do was get into the steps. I hadn't really, you know, earnestly taken the steps. This sponsor was, I'm trying not to cuss, but he was a tough love moon. And he saw me coming. He saw me coming a mile away with my BS. You know, he saw the stories, the rationalizations, the justifications, all that stuff. And he just laid it out for me. He's like, you're going to work the steps. You're going to journal. You're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. You're going to stay out of a relationship for 6 months. And I was like, okay. I mean, I didn't really have any play. I was desperate. I was really desperate. And that desperation translated to willing to do anything. I had the willingness to go to any lengths. And for me at that time, those were the lengths I was willing to go to. And that particular sponsor lived an hour and a half away from me. And I had to commit to go up once a month and work the steps with that man. And I did that for 2 years with him. He told me that whenever I'd call him up with some drama, oh, at the business meeting, they said this. And he was like, uh-uh. It was like, read, write, pray, write some more, and then if you're not in the solution, call me. He said that I am not going to be your higher power. Sponsorship is not about me being your higher power. Get with God. And wow. You know, and I would take those suggestions, and I would put them to use, you know, and guess what? Lo and behold, it worked. It worked. Now, as I was working the steps, step one, step two, step three, 6 months started to roll around. And my attitude was of, okay, where's he at? Where's he at? And it didn't happen. It didn't happen for some time later. And by the time it did happen that I could actually share myself sexually with somebody instead of take, when I could actually show up and be that and be, you know, a sharing partner sexually with somebody, I already had a God. I was already well into the steps, well into my own spiritual awakening. There was no chance that that person was going to become my higher power. No chance that, less of a chance, I should say, because I was working the steps, that I had to get loaded around it. I had some idea of what it was to be an equal sexually with somebody instead of just take. And that I'm one of the ones that suggestion worked for. Thank you, Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have to get loaded just to have sex. And, you know, it's just been such a struggle. And no, I shouldn't say that. It's not been a struggle. There's been like these series of surrenders along the way around that. I spent a lot of years abstinent. And sometimes that wasn't by choice, you know. It was like, oh. And most of the time it was by choice. Ultimately it was my choice. I could have done a lot of other things that I chose not to do. Because I was just, it's just too risky. It's just too risky. I've worked hard to get something inside here. That big old gaping hole started to fill in. Little by little by little by little. And it's just too risky. It's too compromising to go out and seek sex the ways that I sought sex before. You know what I'm talking about. Prostitutes and bathhouses and the bars and all that stuff. It's just too much. That doesn't mean I don't date. But I'm definitely more careful about that. So there have been times where I've been challenged sexually, and it's not Viagra moments, not that way. Check it out. A couple of years ago, I went to Peru. I had the opportunity to be part of a Narcotics Anonymous function in Lima, Peru. And, you know, I've been since in the 80s, I've accepted myself as a gay man. And in Peru, I don't know what happened, but I met this woman who was in the fellowship who was very attractive, not just physically, but spiritually. And she was in service, and we just hit it off. And she spoke no English. And so I got to use my Spanish skills, right? And I got to use my Spanish skills with her, and we just hit it off. And before I knew it, I had this attraction to her that I had not experienced in a long time, male or female. And it rocked my world. I was like, what the hell happened there? You know? Nothing happened physically. But it was such a spiritual and emotional connection that it would have been a matter of days, I think. But, you know, it just wasn't the time. And it just, you know, it kind of helped me see that what I think I know is not always the truth. And it goes back to that sentence that's in the basic text that says, everything I know is subject to revision, especially what I know about the truth. And what does that have to do? What that has to do with sexuality or being gay or whatever, you know, I thought of myself as being this in-the-box kind of guy. And guess what? There is no box. There is no box. Except the ones that I create that are part of my disease that keeps me limited. And I don't want limitation anymore. That's Narcotics Anonymous. That's Narcotics Anonymous. Now, I'm not dating women. That doesn't mean I think I'm bisexual all of a sudden. That may have been a moment of trisexuality clean, but no. It just was an experience. It was an experience. And I'm grateful for the experience because it helped me in other areas of my life in the ways that I see myself in the box. And that I recognize myself, that it's a self-limiting perspective, that I can break out of that anytime I choose to. That whenever I think I can't, shouldn't, won't, then it doesn't have to be the truth. That's not the truth of it. Now, When I was a kid, I have to say this. Wait a minute. How many people in here have less than 29 days clean? Who's got 20? Yeah! Welcome. Welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. We're glad you're here. Welcome home. You're a part of us. And I'm glad that just flashed. Thank you, God. Because I didn't hear that. We didn't ask. But newcomers are our lifeblood. We may not tell you why you're our lifeblood in the beginning, but the truth is this. You're our lifeblood because we like what we have and want to keep it. And the way we get to keep it is to give it to you. So if you're not coming and you're not showing up, we're not having a chance to give it away. And that doesn't work out for us very well. So glad you're here. When I was a kid, I was brought up in bars. My mom was the barmaid at this bar. Doesn't exist anymore, so I can say it. It was called Andy's Bar on Main Street in Vacaville. And it was on the other side of Main Street. And it was a beer bar at the time in Vacaville. Okay. At the time in California, they had what they call beer laws. And there were certain bars that if they didn't sell hard liquor, if they sold just beer and wine, kids could go in. Thank you. And boy, did we. I learned how to play shuffleboard and the jukebox and Jimmy Buffett and Margaritaville and, you know, all these old songs that come up that I hear on the radio. I'm like, oh, Andy's Bar. And, you know, my parents were part of these clubs, these lodges with animal names. And, you know, all they did was, like, some philanthropy stuff and drank a lot. And so that's where I was raised. I was raised in that mindset. And there was a part of it where there was always these bikers that came over, and my mom was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And these were the guys that I aspired to be. I looked up to these guys, you know? And so when my feelings of sexuality, of being homosexual, were coming up when I was about 12 years old, I fought that and fought that and fought that because those guys would never accept that. And those were the ones, like I said, who I looked up to and I wanted to be like, you know? And when I was 12 years old, I attempted suicide. 12 years old, taking a bottle of pills and hoping not to wake up again. Because of that shame that I felt inside, that ugliness, that self-loathing, which I didn't know there was a word for. You know, I just hated myself. I was so terrified that somebody was going to find out. And so I took these pills, and I never told anybody, and I threw up. I threw them up later. I lived, obviously. But this is not an apparition. And you know, that was a secret that I held for a long time. And it wasn't. It was really what did it. What helped turn it around for me was soon thereafter, my uncle, who's only 4 years older than me, got me stoned. Me and my best friend, he smoked some weed with, and all we could do at 12 years old, all that night, is just laugh. Laugh and giggle and oh, giggle, 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 giggle. And I wanted to do that the next day. And the next day. And all the days after. I got numb. I got to feel different, other than. I got to feel part of. Okay? And it went that way up until I was 27 years old. From 12 to 27, 15 years, a day at a time, I sought drugs. I sought escape. I sought different feelings. I sought acceptance. And I wanted to share that because there's somebody new here, and I didn't really talk about using very much except other manifestations of addiction like sex. But it is important. We get here because we use drugs. And then the other manifestations of addiction that come over time, those of you who've been around a while, you know they show up, and you get to work on those too. But it was drugs that helped me. I think back now, I look back, and as a teenager, I think it was the drugs that helped me stay numb enough that I didn't have to go there with the suicide. It just kept me, it kind of saved my life in a way for a little while. you know? And I played the role. I played this huge, huge role of being a tough guy, trying to emulate the biker dudes that I looked up to. And, you know, I did that all through high school. I was terrified, still, all the way through, terrified that somebody would see through it or hear the little lisp in my voice as my voice changed. And then I'd have to beat them up. And so, you know, all the image, you know, there's lots of ways that we have our little images, right? So that you can't see past. You can't see the fear, the weakness, the whatever, you know, the soft spots. And so you harden up. And the rest of my recovery, the rest of my life is going to be about undoing all of those little images one at a time, you know, for the rest of my life. In one way or other, the belief systems that were deep-seated from early on. I want to talk about the Army. I went into the United States Army right after I graduated from high school. They taught me a trade. I was a medic. I was a medic among other medics. And I came out United States Army. Thank you very much. And I was stationed over in Germany. And my little Vacaville, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin kind of attitude was met with what I consider to be my queen mother, Dennis, from Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and his Teddy Pendergrass kind of mode. And I don't know, he just kind of brought me out in a way. He made it safe for me to come out in the United States Army. He died in 1994 from AIDS. But we got to be best friends and somebody that I love and cherish. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that he was there in that platoon in the midst of these tanks in Germany and this cavalry battalion. And there was a whole bunch of us there. We'd get together and move from one base to another and just party in the dorms. And even though I got to come to accept myself in a lot of ways, my disease really took off there. It really took off because they advocated in the Army at that time anyway. They denied, of course. Someone's listening. No. They advocated drinking. They advocated lots of drinking. And so we did that with abandon. And so much so that the time came that I actually acted out sexually with another soldier. I mean, I did a whole bunch of other times too, but this time we got caught. And you know what? It turned out to be kind of a little witch hunt, and they asked, and I told, and I got put out. I got put out of the service. And you know what? I spent a lot of years as a victim of the United States government. I thought I was a victim. But addicts cannot maintain recovery in victimhood. And my sponsor... that was one of the things that my sponsor saw coming in me. Poor me. All these terrible things and poor me. And he was like, oh, hell no. No. In the four-step guide, there's a section in the four-step guide, the old four-step guide. Some of you may not know that there's actually a four-step guide before there was the dots. And before there were the dots in the step working guide. And there's a section there that is called Times We Felt Victimized. And it was through my first inventory that I recognized that I knew the rules. I knew the rules. I knew the rules going in, and I broke them. I was responsible for the consequences, and I got to get over being a victim. Over that and a whole bunch of other issues. But it was the United States Army, and I'm grateful for the Army. For the last 18 months, I've been teaching. I've been teaching phlebotomy and medical assisting and EKG and lab assistants, and the Army gave me that. And I had no idea that I would ever be able to teach. I just never saw myself as that, you know, as being able to carry something to somebody else in the way that they could get it that way, other than my experience as an addict and sharing in meetings. So it was very special to be able to do that this last year and a half. And so when I was in Peru, I got to take a little trip into the mountains of Peru and go to a place called Machu Picchu. And it was devastatingly beautiful and spiritual. I felt a connection with the God of my lack of understanding or whatever you want to put it, my higher power, that I've not felt except in other moments of deep meditation, you know, after I've been working at it for a while. It was a very powerful, profound experience. And what happened for me there was the recognition of Narcotics Anonymous effect in my life. Because I could see myself as this little boy in Andy's bar, aspiring to be a barfly like the biker dudes that I looked up to. And that here I am in the Andes Mountains, 10,000 feet in the air, in a spiritual retreat of the Inca Indians, and I've come a long way. That was a huge, huge thing for me, that I was not that little boy that I was that aspired to be a barfly at Andes and Main Street in Vacaville. That was the effect of Narcotics Anonymous. That's Narcotics Anonymous. These huge extremes, you know, of life, of living in total scarcity and lack and fear, and degradation and hatred and self-hatred. And then the other extreme of fullness and fulfillment and satisfaction and connectedness and unity. That's Narcotics Anonymous. I get to say, I want to say one thing about unity. It was that first gay lesbian meeting that I got to go to where I experienced unity. But what happened over time is that the unity experience expanded. The unity experience expanded to where I got to see that unity is about relationships. Unity is about relationships with you, members of Narcotics Anonymous. Unity is about relationships with people at work. Unity is about relationships with people in the community, about my relationship with the God of my understanding. Unity is about relationships. And unity in the first tradition is very connected to the first step, as so taught to me by my sponsor, taught to him by his sponsor. And that when there is disunity in my life, when there is disharmony, addiction is at play. And that's how I try to walk through my life. Now, I don't walk through this easy little, you know, turbulent path. Sometimes it gets really turbulent. And I got to look at where the disease of addiction is still active. So unity, in that sense, becomes a major road sign to walk through my life with. I've learned so much. There's still way more to learn. I'm still a deeply flawed person, full of defects of character. But a day at a time, there is hope. I got a chance. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, I'm supposed to say let's thank Joni and Shane for speaking. I'd asked Tom to read We Do Recover, but I didn't see him. Oh, there we go.
Hi, family. My name is Tommy, and I'm an addict. Hey, all we do recover. When at the end of the road we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative, either go on to the best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way is improving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. It's a simple spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous.
Thank you, Tommy.
All right, I guess we're going to make a circle around the room and end with the third step prayer.
God.